Wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Badminton Podcast, a community for badminton players by badminton players, proudly brought to you by Velan. We talk all things badminton and aim to inspire you to be better in your game and in life by celebrating the people and stories of our global badminton community, whether they be past or present professional players, social players, officials or fans.
We're your hosts, Jeff and Henry, and we love badminton. From the bottom of our hearts, we'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has listened to, shared, and been part of the podcast. It wouldn't be possible without you all. If you do enjoy our episodes and can spare just a couple of dollars each month, you can really help keep the podcast going by supporting us on Patreon. Just visit www.patreon.com/thebadmintonpodcast. We'll leave the link in the description. Now, this morning, I'm with 29-year-old Neil Yakura. He's Canada's number one men's doubles player. He's won 5 national championships and 4 Pan American championships. He's also an Olympian, having competed at the Tokyo 2020 Games, and is a 2-time Commonwealth Games athlete. He's based in Toronto, I think. And outside badminton, he likes Valorant, sneakers, and music.
Number one, I'll go with variety. You need to mix up your shots. And I've learned this the hard way. I've played matches that I've lost that I know I shouldn't have because I was so in the moment and I was so heated. And I just tried to crank everything, especially for me. I'm not the biggest guy. I don't hit the hardest, but I do mix up usually very well. And I have decent disguise on my shots. And I didn't use it at that time. So variety would be one. Patience, same time. You don't want to go for these big cross court winners all the time or stuff like that. You want to build up till you get that good lift. And the third one would be take more initiative in the mid. I've definitely heard this way too many times where I take things way too late in the mid. And then I'm that little like half second late on the mid court. And obviously, you know, at that level, that little half a second, once you let it drop a little bit, your shot quality's gone, they read you, and it just doesn't end well for you. So taking things, like really focusing on the mid-court more.
Neil, it's been a long time coming, but welcome onto the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was excited for this. I was waiting for that invite.
Oh yeah, I've been asking you for a while, but you said that you were going to be too shy. You don't seem shy at all.
Hey, I was just joking.
Yeah, I think you were joking.
I was just playing around.
I don't think you have a problem with talking, do you?
No, I'm okay.
All right. So I had to look up Valorant and I've got no idea about it. What is it? What do you like about it? What is it?
So it's a PC game, first person shooter. It's very similar to Counter-Strike, if you know what that is.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've been to Asia.
Yeah.
I've been to internet cafes.
Exactly.
Badminton trips. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it actually like stemmed off of Counter-Strike. Obviously, the whole idea is exactly the same, but they just kind of made it a bit more modern.
Okay.
So it's like same thing, defusing a spike. And, you know, there's characters now, instead of just with like guns and grenades, it's now guns and abilities. So it's almost like they have superpowers. So they have like flashes and they can teleport or they can send out recons. And there's a bunch of different things for different characters. So it's definitely like a big communication part involved in that, which I'm not very good at because I haven't been playing the game for that long.
Okay.
So a lot of my friends like kind of flame me a lot for not calming when things are going on. Like I'll die and then I don't really say anything and then they'll die from the same person. They're like, yo, why didn't you tell me? He was there.
He was there. Yeah. Wait, can you still talk? You can't still communicate when you're dead, right? Or you can still communicate with your team?
You can.
Oh, okay.
So basically we just use, do you know Discord?
Yep.
Yeah, we just use Discord, so we're just talking all the time anyway.
On Discord.
So it doesn't matter if we're dead or not.
Yeah, okay, nice. All right, yeah, I do remember Counter-Strike. I used to remember when I was training in Malaysia and Indonesia, and you'd go to the internet cafe between sessions.
Yeah.
And then there'd be like 10-year-olds just schooling you.
I had the same experience too when I went to Indo. So I've definitely been there. It's not fun. It was not fun.
All right, nice. And then tell me about these sneakers. For the listeners out there, you can't really see the video, but there are four pairs of Nikes behind Neil at the moment, sitting on this beautifully crafted shelf. And he just told me he's got a whole room full of sneakers. So I've never gotten into the sneaker kind of thing, I guess. So what's the deal with sneakers and what's collecting them mean?
For me, it just started out as like another piece to my outfit. And I'm a big guy on like what I wear. So with clothing and shoes and hats, like I have like 15 hats and God knows how many sneakers. And like, I always like to mix things up with what I wear, and sneakers kind of like add that like last pop to the outfit. So, and then there's, if you know about a little bit of sneakers, there's like hype around some sneakers. So they can actually be investment pieces if you take good care of them. Like a lot of those that you see there still look like brand new basically, because I really just wear them. And then if I get even a little speck of dirt, I'll go and clean it off so that they look brand new, because a lot of the shoes do have like value, they hold value and can even resell for more if you got them for retail. So it's also a way for me, if I need some extra cash here and there, I can just start selling off some of the shoes.
Have you actually sold any though?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I've sold so many. There's pairs that I double up on. I'll buy two.
Yeah.
And then I'll sell the other one. So like, for example, there's the pair at the top over there I got for not retail, but still a good price because I got it when it released. And now they're, I think, double, almost double of what they were selling for back then.
Okay.
So I have one pair that I wear, and then I have another pair that's just in the box still that I'm going to try and hold on to. And I hope the value goes up even more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, are you one of those crazy people that like sits at the store like 2 days before and like lines up like crazy?
I think I tried it a couple times, but I don't do it every time, no.
Okay. Then how do you get access to those limited pieces?
I don't have many limited pieces actually.
Okay.
Most of these are pretty like general release, I guess you could say. But I don't have too many of like the super, super crazy ones. Yeah. Sometimes you just get lucky if you know when they're gonna drop online.
Yeah.
Because they always tell you, there's like Twitter accounts and stuff where you can follow, and I'll tell you when it's gonna release. So sometimes, usually they release at like 6 a.m. here. So, you know, you just wake up at 5 something and you get ready to get on your computer and your phones. So right when it hits 6 o'clock, you're logging in, and sometimes you get lucky and you hit it, and other times like you get the site crash.
Yeah. The site crash.
Yeah.
You have like 5 devices trying to buy it at the same time.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Nice. At least you try to sell some. I know that my partner, she loves designer bags, and she's always like, they're going up in price. And I'm like, yeah, they are, but you'll never sell them anyway. And she's like, yeah.
It's hard to, if you've had it for a while, I think it is hard to part ways with it.
Yeah.
I have a pretty bad like connection to things. I find it so hard to let go of stuff. Usually I sell mostly the stuff I like double up on. That's fine because I still have one, right?
Yeah.
So some of the stuff that I have here, I want to sell it, but then I just haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Just haven't gotten around to it for some reason.
Yeah. I'm so busy, you know?
Yeah. So busy. No time to list it. Where do you list it, by the way? Is it like Facebook Marketplace, or is there like a better kind of...
There's Facebook Marketplace, and there's also other groups within Facebook. So there's a few groups like in Toronto specifically, mm-hmm. that are just like solely for sneaker exchanging or sneaker trading and selling. So there's a few of those groups I'm in. Most people usually go on, you know what StockX is?
No.
StockX and another one called Goat and Grailed is like an app where people buy and resell their shoes.
Okay.
But it needs to go through that app. So I think they might take like a cut.
They take a cut.
Yeah. So it's easier and better to just do it locally. And the Toronto like sneaker community is pretty like big. So it's fairly easy to find like a buyer for stuff.
Yeah.
There's always someone looking to buy. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. That's good. All right. I've learned a bit about shoes or sneakers, but I'd also like to hear a little bit about you. So Yakura, it sounds very Japanese. What's your background?
Yeah. So my dad is Japanese. He was born in Japan, but he moved here when he was like 5. So he doesn't speak Japanese. So he just feels like a Canadian to me. And my mom is from Indonesia.
Okay. Do you speak any Japanese?
No, zero. Well, like, yeah, very small things.
Okay.
That everyone else can say.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. And then, Neil, how did you start with your badminton journey? So when was it that you got started? How? And then, like, what were the steps that got you to where you are today? Like, why did you want to take it seriously? Did it start out as a hobby, or how did it go from there?
So it actually started, if you want to say, the first time I picked up a racket, mm-hmm. I was probably about like 3 or 4. So both my parents played. They actually met playing badminton. And then my dad, when I was 3 or 4, he took 2 broken rackets. He found, I guess, one was just the handle with the cone, and the other piece was about like maybe a quarter or a third of the shaft and the head were still good. And he just like cleaned out the cone of the handle part, and he just shoved in the broken shaft part in there, and then he just glued it. Yeah, he just stuck it in there, glued it, and he made me this little mini racket. And I would go with them to whenever they played and just hit with my mom. But that was just like me touching the bird. And then when I was 9, then they asked me if I wanted to start like going to an actual training or like a team. I used to live out east, about 25 minutes from Markham. Markham is obviously right now the big badminton hub. So I lived out east in this city called Pickering. It's a little bit smaller, not a whole lot was going on over there at that time, especially no badminton. So we actually had to drive. We drove even further east, another like 15 minutes to another city where this guy was running a club out of a high school, like after school in the evenings. So I started there. His name was Wayne King. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He coached the University of Toronto team when Michelle was there. So he was my first coach. And then I stayed there for like 1.5 years. And then I was losing every single tournament. First round, 15-0, 15-0. I wasn't getting any points. Like maybe winning a couple rallies, but I was not getting a single point for like a solid 1.5 years.
When you were 9.
So yeah, 9. And then after 1.5 years, I was like, maybe I was like fueled by that or something, but I wanted to go get better training because I felt like I wasn't getting any better there. And then my parents are good friends with, you know, Joshua Yu, his mom and dad, they also both play. And his mom was a coach at one of the clubs in Markham. So they decided to move me and my brother there. My brother played for a little bit too. So we moved there after like 1.5 years. That was like in 2003 when the club had just opened. And then from there, like my improvement rate was just like through the roof. I think within that year, I was already winning provincials. It was crazy how fast that went up. So that really like motivated me to keep going more and more. And then my dad used to like always have these like bootleg or burned DVDs of badminton tournaments. So he would get me like, you know, All England's, Olympics and whatever, like World Champs, all the good tournaments. And he showed me, I think it was the 2004 Olympic. So Taufik,
yeah.
When he won. And I think from there, I was just like, okay, I'm going for badminton. Like badminton is the sport I'm going to go for. Because at that time, from when I was also 5 until grade 10 in high school, I was playing baseball competitively.
Okay.
On a rep team. Because me and my brother both played baseball first. We started with baseball. And then we tried badminton until we got older. So when I was in like grade 10, it was at like 14, 15. My mom was like, you got to pick one. Because if you want to be like really good at one of them, you're not going to be able to do both. So I picked badminton and my brother picked baseball. So we went separate. So from then on, I just took like, even back then, I think you might have this too, maybe. I'm not sure. Back then, we didn't train as much as kids train now. We only had, at least for us here, we only had 2 team trainings a week.
Okay.
For 2 hours each. And then maybe 1 private. That was all we had. The other days, I don't even know if I went to the club. Maybe I went to go play by myself or with like other people, but training wise, that's all we had. So I think it's pretty crazy that kids now, they train already like 5-6 days a week.
Yeah.
So I think the reason I like sprouted or like went up in my game so much was because even though we didn't have training, I would still go most of the days of the week just to play with the adults at that time that were like my dad's age or like 30, 40. So playing with them, I think I like matured really quick. And then in 2006, I think I was only 13. My mom asked me if I wanted to go train in Indo. So I said yes. And we flew there. I don't know if you know Jarum. Yeah. You know the club Jarum.
Yeah.
And it was in Kudus, which is in like the middle of nowhere. So we flew there, got to Jarum. My mom, like, basically, we get to the front and with the car, take my luggages out. My mom says, like, good luck, have fun, I love you. And she left. And I was just like, huh? So I was stuck there, trained there for 3 months by myself when I was 13. I think that was a big help in my game of maturing very fast, because most of the people I was around the whole time were like probably 15, 16. But the kids I trained with were like around my age and younger. Actually, funny enough, one of the kids in my group at that time was Kevin Sanjaya.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I met him when I was 13, he was 11, which was pretty crazy. And then there's a couple other guys. Who else was there? Maybe you don't know those guys, but some of them ended up coming to Canada later on to coach, which was like really crazy. So yeah, just being around, you know, high level, even if you're not playing with the highest level, I think being around it, you like at a young age, you like soak in a lot, right?
Yeah.
And you can actually, if you're actually watching and paying attention, you actually learn so much. I was able to like watch and kind of just copy when I was younger. And then now when I try and do that, I find it so much harder. I still watch so much footage of this stuff, but I can't just copy it.
It's
so much more complex now.
Yeah. Yeah. I did Tangkas. And so Marcus Fernaldi Gideon was there when I was training. And yeah, the same thing, right? There's quite a few other really good players who went and coached in Europe. A lot of them went to Europe to coach and train. One of the guys went to Taiwan to train. But yeah, exactly the same as you. I think I was 14, maybe 1 year older. And I was there by myself as well. And it was pretty crazy. And it's crazy how you just watch. And then did you ever notice that you just play it and you're like, whoa, I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah, exactly. You just try it a couple of times. You're like, oh, wait a minute.
How come I can do that?
I got it.
I didn't practice it at all. I just saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely think maybe it was a lot easier for me because it was singles. I feel like I'm a doubles player now, but deep down, I feel like I have like a more full understanding of singles than I do for doubles. It's kind of weird because I've been playing doubles for a long time, but just when I watch singles, I understand the tactics and I feel the rhythm change and everything. Like I can read it so much better than doubles, which is why I actually enjoy going to some tournaments and like coaching our singles people who like, because when we go, we don't have coaches, right? For most of the individual tournaments. So like if I'm not playing that day because it's singles, some of them will be like, oh, can you come coach? And I'll be like, okay, cool. And I feel like it's so much easier for me to like coach singles than if it was for me to go and coach a doubles game. So that's really weird.
Well, because I always played singles, so I always find it easy to coach singles anyway. But what about the doubles is harder, do you feel, to coach?
I think that just watching the doubles, I can't really put everything together as well as singles. Like I feel like even me playing, I'm still sometimes very lost. If I play against a much higher level,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
But when I watch singles, it's just like no matter how high the level is, I'm like I can see things that can be fixed or like strategies that could be used. But if it's for doubles, like I can't really see them that clearly. I'm not sure why. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think it's just put simply, it might just be faster, and it might just be. I think it's so with doubles for me, it's just so much related to shot quality as well. So that even if something is correct or potentially the right tactic, if the shot quality is not there, then you get punished straight away. Or else in singles, if the shot quality is not quite there, but you do get punished, but it's not as brutal of maybe.
Yeah. You might still have a chance to recover from it.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of your career, when was that transition from singles to doubles? Like when did you decide that you would be a better doubles player?
That was 2013, like 9 years ago.
Okay. Yep. And what brought that on?
I think I just kind of was a bit more realistic with how my game was. You know, I was already 20 at that time, and I hadn't even played any internationals really, other than like Canada Open or like Canadian Challenge. And I didn't really see much potential there to go far in singles. So I just like reality checked myself, and I was like, if you want to like really make it somewhere, I think you should try, at least try to go for doubles first. And then, so that year, I still played Canadian National singles. That was my last singles tournament, I think. And then after that, I just dropped in. I actually went right after Nationals. I went to Jarum, Jakarta for doubles.
Okay. Yeah.
And then from there, I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to stick with doubles. Because after that training, I went for 6 weeks. And then I played tournament after, and it was like the result was better. And my game felt like a lot better. So I was like, okay, I think I have a better chance at this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that just brings me back to something that Ms. Boon said to me. The year before I went to Tangkas, I went to Nusa Mansuri in Malaysia to train in Ms. Boon's club. And he distinctly told me that wherever, if you train in Asia and then you go back to say Australia or Canada where the level is not as high, it's usually about 1 to 3. So if you train for 1 month in Malaysia, then it would take you 3 months to kind of lose it. And then you go back to your old ways or the old speed or something like that. So yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I felt that because I played the tournament pretty soon after I came back from Indo, and that tournament I felt like a god. And then probably I'd say like a month later, I was like back to like struggling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I know that feeling.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of doing all the training, obviously it's a real difficulty, say in Canada, because of the sparring won't be as good as say Indo, especially the other Asian countries. But where did you find yourself having to go and train in order for you to try to get to your best?
Like which countries?
Yeah. So which countries and what parts of certain countries did you find really useful, like the training for you?
Well, early on, like with my first doubles partner, we just strictly went to Indo, I think. So we went twice, I believe. And I have like decent connection in Indo to train with Jarum. So it was just easier that way.
Yeah.
And then after that, when I switched partners with Jason, after we played a couple years and we had some decent results, I guess maybe people were kind of more welcoming for us to come. So we tried some in Europe. We trained in France. France was really good, even though it's completely different, right? You know, about like the short intensity, right?
Yep.
And we also went to Singapore. So two very, very different structures. But yeah, I guess with Singapore, I think Jason had talked to maybe Lo Kan Yu or something. And then I think that was mainly for his singles, but then he also asked if we could go for doubles too. And they were very welcoming or open to that. France, I think it started with Kristen and Rachel. They got kind of in touch with France first. And then I think Jason and I just kind of asked if we could tag along because we were playing the same tournaments. So at that time, so we kind of just tagged along with them. And then after the first time, then I really liked it. I liked how they train there. So I went back a couple more times after.
To France.
To France, yeah. I've also done Denmark. I did Denmark by myself once because I forget where Jason was. Maybe he couldn't go or something, but I went to Denmark for like 10 days between tournaments.
Was that in the club system or within the national?
Club system, yeah. I went to Greve.
Okay, yeah.
My old coach from like back when I was playing singles, he played for Greve for like 10 years.
Okay.
This is like a while ago. Like he was on the team when like Matthias Bo was there on that team and Joachim Fischer. And then also back then he invited one of the Danish guys to come and do a camp at our club. So that guy that did the camp was the head coach at that club at that time. So I just reached out to him and then he said, yeah, I can come and train. And they found me like a homestay.
Yeah.
So it worked out really good. I didn't have to pay for training. They took care of me with food most of the time. So it was really nice.
Did you have to do any coaching while you were there?
Nope.
No. Okay.
Nope. I think because I was only there for like 10 days.
I think
if I was there for longer, they would ask me to do some coaching for sure.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now, just a quick word from our sponsors.
The Badminton Podcast is brought to you by Volant. Volant was first born out of our frustration with the confusing, bright, and unsightly clothes and equipment that we saw in the badminton world. But now, it's so much more than that. Our mission is to accelerate the growth of badminton by providing players with products that enhance their love for the sport. All in all, it's high-quality gear that makes you look and feel great on and off the court. So make sure you check us out at volantbadminton.com and follow us on our socials at volantbadminton.
Okay. All right. So when you're looking back at what you've done so far, look, I know that you're still actively competing and training. Would there be something that you would have changed in what you've done to this day? So is there something you'd be like, oh, maybe I should have just gone with baseball? No, but is there something there that you'd be like, oh, if I could change that, then that could have made a difference in this way? Or is there anything that, not that you're regretting anything, but any lessons to be learned in your journey so far?
Yeah, definitely. My approach to training and the sparring was a lot different than it is now. And I think the focus on at training now, I try to focus more on one thing first and really build that up, as opposed to before I don't even think I focused on anything. I was just, because I was very new to doubles, I was kind of just doing whatever, you know, we did when I was in Indo. So I'd just be doing smash and drive.
Yeah.
Control. That's it.
Yeah.
Like literally two drills, maybe front court. Like at that time, I didn't, like my mind, I guess, was not really opened up to all the different things that I could do to practice. So I think if I had learned a little bit earlier when I was younger about more doubles stuff, I think that would have been good. And then I think taking advantage more. So with my first partner, probably we should have taken advantage more when we traveled to train more at these other places. Like if we spent a few weeks in Europe, we should have tried to find a place in Europe to train. And even at tournaments, like maybe because we were too shy to ask, we were just like these crappy Canadians. So we were maybe too shy to ask other people if they wanted to like spar or train at that time. So I think after that, when I switched partners and I played with Jason, after that, we were more comfortable to ask people if they want to train, and they were open to it. And then now I feel very easy to ask people to train with, and they're pretty open to it. So it's nice to have that now. So I probably would have done that earlier, because I think that makes a big difference, especially when you have like back-to-back-to-back tournaments, you can get that like solid sparring in between.
Yeah, definitely. I remember speaking to Kirsty Gilmore about this and the McGees, so Sam McGee, and he was saying that quite a lot of the time, us smaller countries, we need to band together a little bit training, right? Because China will go with five men singles players, 10 men's doubles, so maybe not 10, but a lot, right? So they've always got heaps of sparring, but then the small guys like us, we need to band together and train together.
We literally have like one per event.
Yeah, one per event.
We got one men's singles, one women's singles. Some of the countries don't even have, like, if you say like New Zealand was only mixed. Ollie and, yeah. And Anona, right?
Yeah.
It's really tough.
Yeah. And look, we just got back from Commonwealth Games, as did you. And for us, I guess, other than say a Sudermen Cup or Thomas Uber Cup, which isn't as long, you've got Pan Am Games and stuff, which is probably good as well. We don't really have we've got an Oceania one, but it doesn't go very long. It's just a few days. You don't really build that teamwork. But what I found as the team is that in badminton, we don't get to play many team sports or team events for a long period of time. And we had a good 2 weeks in Birmingham and the games. And how did you find, do you really enjoy the team culture?
Yeah, I think team events are probably my favorite, to be honest. Especially if your team is like, if you guys have bonded before, if it's not like a brand new team, then I think it might be a little bit easier, because you have that kind of chemistry. But if it's a completely new team, it could be a little bit, you know, this one's kind of shy, doesn't really want to do much with the team yet. But definitely for me, all my team event experiences have been really good. I don't recall ever having a very bad team experience. So I kind of I always look forward to competing in team events. Mm-hmm. I just think it's like the energy that people can give off, especially when you're playing like Sudermen Cup in China in 2019. I don't think we've ever cheered that loud before for each other. It was pretty crazy. Maybe because we were like doing really well.
Yeah.
So it kind of made it a little bit of a difference. But I mean, we won some big matches there, which was, I think, really good for the sport for Canada. At that time, there was like the three tiers of teams.
Yep. Yep.
For Sudermen, and we were in like the second tier, but there were still some strong teams there.
Yeah.
You know, we had to play like France, Germany, Singapore. Yeah, those were like the big ones. And we won all those. So it was a lot of the matches were close. And I think it came down to like how involved the team was. Like the support behind the court was pretty big. So that's what I love about team events.
Yeah, that's really good. Which kind of brings me to my next question, which is you don't really see many team events in like tennis. I'm not sure if you follow tennis much, but you've got like the Davis Cup and then you've got the Laver Cup now where it's like Europe against the world and stuff like that. Because I guess if you're in this team, because badminton is kind of an individual sport or a pair, right? And then you're in a national program and then or a national team is selected for a certain event to play something. But then we go down the lines of, say, the people who want to go independent. So if you look at Malaysia, there's definitely like Liu Daran.
Lizzie Jia.
Yeah, Lizzie Jia. Did he go back or is he still independent?
I believe he's still independent.
Okay, yeah. Sure. I thought he went back for some reason. And then in Indo, then like Jarum will send their own players instead of the ones coming from the national program, Pelatnas, and that kind of thing. So there are some independents, but I guess this is a topic that could be a little bit controversial in terms of the control that, say, national federations have on certain people entering certain tournaments. So what are your thoughts on that? And where do you see badminton progressing? Do you see it progressing to more of a tennis style where kind of anyone can play anything and you've got your own team around you? Or do you still think that we're a little bit stuck in the national program system where you kind of have to be there, otherwise you're not really relevant?
I don't know. That's a good question. Obviously, I think I'd say Victor was the trendsetter for this because leaving a place like the Danish national setup is a pretty big deal because I think they're known to be a very good national setup. So, and for him also to be like the top player in the world makes it even crazier. But I mean, I guess for him, he knows what he wants and he knows what he needs to do to get better. And I guess maybe he also wanted to like challenge himself. I don't know if he has bigger plans for it in the future, but I definitely think for the right person, it could be the right choice. Like maybe at the right time in your career, you could do it like maybe like that, where Victor had already done quite a bit with the national center, then he could try to, you know, step out and see what happens. But I think if you haven't really had that much accomplishments, then maybe it's not quite the thing for you, or maybe it is. Maybe that's why you haven't had the accomplishments yet. But just the way I see it is, I think, for example, for Lizzie Jia, for him to leave, I thought was a little bit odd. I don't really recall what his like reasoning was, but wasn't really a fan of him leaving because, like, no disrespect, he's an amazing player, but he maybe just won what, All England?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. He already won All England by the time, yeah, he was starting to go independent. Yeah.
So other than that, hasn't really been much. So for him to just be like, I want to leave, was a little bit weird to me. Maybe it was for, I don't know, like obviously we don't know what's going on behind the scenes there. Maybe he was getting mistreated or something. I don't know. But I mean, they're the reason he got to where he is now, you know, like they groomed him from very young. I know in Malaysia, they take them from very young into their sports school and then through this system, you know, this pathway up to BAM. And for him to kind of just leave after that was a little bit weird. I thought that was a little bit disrespectful in a way. Maybe not disrespectful, but just like, I think he should have given it some time, to be honest. But I mean, I can't say anything. I'm just this Canadian player.
No, that's all right. Everyone's got their own opinions. And I think you're right in that you definitely... I don't know if maybe in Asia it's okay where badminton knowledge is more diverse and there's more badminton knowledge out in the general community. But if, say, someone from Australia just wanted to go independent, I think it'd be quite hard because they wouldn't know what it takes. They wouldn't have been exposed that much to international badminton that, oh, I'm just going to go independent, but then I don't actually know how to train properly. I don't know what the world's best and good at. Tennis is different, I think, because everyone, not everyone knows, but it's just, it's, there's a lot more people with a lot more knowledge, I think, in tennis in the world generally of high performance tennis. But then badminton, yeah, you need to know what you actually want. So of course, Victor, I'm sure he knows exactly what he wants. And that's how he can set that up, right?
Yeah.
But then, yeah, I guess it's a fine line between, yes, they groom Zija, but at the same time, what freedoms should you have as an athlete? And yeah, I don't know. I assume there was some good sponsorship deals as well. So if there's good sponsorship deals and he can get his own nutritionist, his own chef, his own this and that, then that's cool.
Yeah. I guess if it's for a payday, then, I mean, you could also do that later on. I feel like, I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Yeah. That's cool. All right. And then if we switch gears a little bit here, this is a question that I actually asked Peter Gator. So I'm asking the same question. So I hope you feel really important. So preparation wise, what's kind of like your go-to routine? Like, is there some kind of food that you genuinely like to eat? Is there some kind of training? Do you like to lift heavy before a match, a couple of days before? Do you just rest? Like, what's your thing? Do you like to really sweat in your warm-up and sweat them if you're playing in the afternoon? Do you get on court that morning? Do you just have a really light hit, or do you actually move and do you actually work a little bit harder to get the body ready? Or like, what's your preparation like?
So it'll probably obviously depend on the resources I have at that tournament. So if I have access to like gym or something, I actually do like to lift a couple of days before and like fairly heavy, obviously not like to the point where I'm going to get hurt, but fairly heavy weight. I don't know why. A couple of days before always makes me feel good on the day of. It'll change here and there, but once I have like a routine for warm up, I just stick to that routine for a certain period of time. If I play in the late afternoon, evening, I'll 100% want to go early in the morning to get some court time in. I think a lot of us like to do that actually. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty big. But if I have a morning match, then I usually just wake up and shower. Sometimes I don't eat.
Okay.
Because even when I train, I don't eat before training. Mm-hmm. I have this thing where I just don't like to eat before training. I don't know why. So if my match is like a 9 a.m., like the first match, then I probably won't eat. But if it's like 10:30, 11, then maybe I'll eat a little bit. For my warm-ups, I get a sweat, but it's not like, I'm not like huffing and puffing, you know, but I'll get my heart rate to a decent level, like 115, 120, just for a short period of time, just so that my mind's a little bit like activated and engaged. Certain foods, not really. I don't recall me having any specific foods.
Okay.
I'd obviously stay away from like pizza or burgers and stuff, but sometimes those are like the only options. I've been to places where it's like
nothing's open.
Yeah, either nothing's open or everything else is so expensive.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've been to some of those countries like Switzerland. Oh my God. Brutal.
I remember I went to the Norwegian International and I bought like this, just this salad thing from the supermarket. It cost me $30 Australian, which is a little bit less, maybe $25 to $30 Canadian.
That's
that was the
insane.
Cheapest thing in the supermarket.
It probably wasn't very big, was it? Like a snack size bowl.
Yeah.
That's another like factor for us too, is because we're not like fully funded like these other countries. So when we eat and stuff, we also need to be very like
price conscious. Yeah.
Yeah. Financially wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to the warm up, this is just based on my experience, but I'd love to hear what you think as well. When you get on court and you've got the 2 minutes to warm up and the umpire's just waiting for you and you're just warming up there, how do you manage this kind of the feeling of your body? Because for me, when I used to go out within that first 2 minutes, that was a really clear sign as to how I was feeling, because sometimes I'd go into that warm up and my legs would just dead heavy, just not moving, feel like absolute crap. And then sometimes in that 2 minute warm up, I'm feeling sprung, I'm ready, I'm moving, I'm relaxed, I'm in my mind clear. And then I had different ways of trying to get out of both, of course. So of course the good one's a good one. You just keep feeding on that, but then trying to deactivate myself from that kind of sluggish feeling. Do you have that as well? Do you sometimes go out there 2 minute warm up and you're like, oh, I just feel slow or sluggish? Do you have that at all?
No, I've never had the sluggish hit me. I'm usually pretty like bouncy and I'm trying to get my warm up going like with good intensity and stuff. But sometimes I feel like if I overdo it, then as soon as the match starts, now I'm frozen.
Oh, you overdo your warm up, as in you're like, you're too...
Not overdo the warm up, I guess just get too excited. So there's too much adrenaline going and it's just the warm up. And then once the match starts, then I'm like, oh shit, like here we go. Okay. And then I'm like, I'm stiff and I'm mishitting really easy shots in the beginning. And then that's when you start to like overthink things and panic. So I've been trying to try and find a little bit of a balance in my warm up to try and keep it active, but you know, a little bit reserved at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything you do just before? Like some of the players will do some footwork or do some like big high tuck jumps and stuff like that. Is that something do you do to kind of fire up?
Yeah, I definitely do footwork all the time. I always do a little bit of footwork just to make sure my legs are ready to, are going to move. Sometimes I do knees to chest, I think, but not every time. But every time I'll do footwork.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I really only do backcourt because I hate being in the front. I absolutely hate being in the front.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think I just, my self-confidence in the front is like beneath this earth.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah. But sometimes I can like, I'll still like do good in the front, but it's just, I've just never really felt comfortable.
Yeah. Okay.
In the front. So,
well,
yeah, I've been working on that. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, you did train with Kevin when you were younger. So get a bit of that rub off onto Kevin.
Yeah. Just got to give him a high five so I can get that feeling.
Yeah. Okay, cool. We're starting to wrap up here, Neil. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover today that we haven't really spoken about?
Maybe I could probably elaborate more on like the training with like Asia and Europe. I probably forgot to mention this. Obviously, you know, like the reason that they only do these short intervals in Europe is because their intensity and quality is so high, right? So that's a very big responsibility on the feeders. Whereas in Asia, sometimes, you know how like, especially Indos and maybe Malaysia, because they're so skilled, they can kind of just stand there, look like they're not trying, but still like obviously still get it back. But it's just that kind of nonchalant vibe that it rubs off on you and kind of doesn't really make you feel like energetic in any way. Whereas in Europe, you know, everyone's yelling and they're motivating you and pushing you to keep going, even though it's only for a short time. But I think that's a big thing. And I almost tried to put those together here with the young group that I have is to try and combine the two. So it'll be not too short, but not too long. But then I also try and really enforce them to keep their energy up and focus while feeding. Because here, especially, kids and younger players are honestly quite bad at feeding.
Terrible at feeding. I know. Yep.
You must know.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm absolutely terrible at feeding. And I learned from when I was a junior because of that coach that was in Greva for 10 years. He already like instilled that into us when we were training with him. So, but not everyone would take it seriously, but I did. And I think that's a big part of why Europe can keep up with Asia is because that quality, and the quality does come, a lot of it comes from how good the feeders are feeding. And that's why I think it's really important that people training now, if you know, and you're if you're in a group of people who aren't feeding you that way, then that could be a huge problem, and that's something you would want to like tackle and try and sort out, because I think it'll help so much.
I think it's one of those things that the initial part where you're trying to tell the feeders to feed better, that's a bit of an awkward conversation to have if you're a player, right? Like, of course, in Europe, they don't care, right? They'll just tell you to your face. It's a bit of a different mentality and it's accepted. But I think taking that step and saying, hey, you give me permission to tell you, but then I also give you permission to tell me when I'm not feeding good enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it works. It works for me and my group because I'm like their senior.
Yep.
And We don't have a coach in our morning sessions. So it's just, I'm basically running the training as at the same time as I'm training. So I think they respect that. So they will listen when I say that, but it's just something because we do train quite early. We train at like 6:30 right now. So sometimes they're not mentally there yet because it's so early. So it'll probably take some time, but I think they know. So like if later on when they get older and they're still playing and they have younger people coming up, I think that's something that they're also going to kind of pass on to next generation, I guess.
Yep, that's right. Yep, cool. Okay, last thing from me today, Neil. I know that you said you like the rear court more, so I'll let you get away at the rear court. If for any doubles players who are listening out there, what three pieces of advice would you give them? They don't have to be complex. They can be simple. Whatever you feel is really effective for, say, a club player or a state player. Doesn't have to be like a national or international player. But for a rear court doubles player, or when someone's playing doubles in the rear court, what three pieces of advice you would give them to be a more effective rear court player?
Let's go with number one. I'll go with variety. You need to mix up your shots. And I've learned this the hard way. I've played matches that I've lost that I know I shouldn't have because I was so in the moment and I was so heated. And I just tried to crank everything, especially for me. I'm not the biggest guy. I don't hit the hardest, but I do mix up usually very well. And I have decent disguise on my shots. So, and I didn't use it at that time. So variety would be one. Patience. Same time, you don't want to go for these big cross court winners all the time or stuff like that. You want to build up till you get that good lift. And the third one would be take more initiative in the mid. I've definitely heard this way too many times where I take things way too late in the mid because as soon as I block the bird down or my partner blocks the bird down, I take a little half step back because I want to move to the back court for the lift. And then I'm that little like half second late on the mid court. And obviously, you know, at that level, that little half a second, once you let it drop a little bit, your shot quality's gone. They read you and it just doesn't end well for you. So taking things like really focusing on the mid court more, even though we're talking about the rear court.
But yeah.
That's part of your job. That's part of your job.
Yeah, rear court player. Yeah, definitely. Awesome pieces of advice there. And then, sorry, this is my last question. For someone who wants to follow on with your progress and see how you're doing in your tournaments, in your training and everything, how can they stay updated with what you're up to?
Mostly just Instagram. I have like Twitter and stuff. I don't use it. So just Instagram, YouTube.
And your handle is?
My Instagram is just my name. So at Neil Yakura.
Cool.
Funky spelling for Neil. For those who don't know, it's not your typical N-E-I-L. It's N-Y-L-Y-A-K-U-R-A. And it's the same thing for my YouTube, which should be more consistent than it is. Still working on my Singapore vlog, which was 2 weeks before Commonwealth.
Yeah.
So once that gets done, then I'll have the Commonwealth one going.
Okay, cool.
Even though we've been already back for what, like three weeks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all right. Video editing is hard. It's very time consuming.
It's just, yeah. Sometimes I don't have the mental energy to do it.
Awesome. So we will put Neil's Instagram handle in the podcast description. So make sure you go check him out and follow him for his adventures, including his eyebrow braiding thingy that I saw.
Threading. Eyebrow threading.
Eyebrow
got threading my eyebrows threaded in the Commonwealth, guys.
Yep.
I recommend.
But Neil, thanks for joining us on the podcast. It was really, really fun to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun. I'm glad I wasn't shy.
You weren't shy at all.
So from Henry and I at the Badminton Podcast, thanks for tuning in to this episode. If you've enjoyed it or found it useful, be sure to share it with your family, friends, teammates, and someone outside your badminton circle too, because with your help, we can show the world how incredible badminton is.
To keep up to date with new episodes and who we're interviewing next, make sure you connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn at The Badminton Podcast, and on Twitter at The Badminton Pod. Feel free to contact us and ask any questions, give us feedback, or request topics for future episodes. We love hearing from you. And remember to check out and shop for your simple and minimalist badminton gear at volantwear.com. Catch you on the next episode. Bye.